from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the recent closures of some local breweries. Then we'll speak with Wisconsin's Poet Laureate about the work she's doing during her term.
For me, it means to spread the good news of poetry through workshops, through readings, through talks, to move about the state, both rural and urban.
Plus, we'll remember celebrated poet and performance artist Andrea Gibson.
I rarely write where I am. I write where I want to be. So my best self is in my poems because I try to write them down and then try to live in that direction. They're sort of like little molds of where I dream to be.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Breweries are an integral part of Wisconsin culture. But recently, some of the state's beloved craft breweries have decided to call it quits. Over the past year, fan favorites like Enlightened Brewery, Good City, and Mobcraft have all announced an end to business in one way or another. Chris Drosner is the Beer Baron columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. And he joins me to talk about these recent closures and what it could mean for the industry. Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
So lately, especially over the last year or so, we've seen a lot of breweries that are going under. I think it's been surprising for many of us, specifically, you know, some bigger ones that have gone under. But as a beer connoisseur, how are you seeing this?
It's kind of a mixed bag. Closings are really hard because you're losing something that for a lot of people really meant a lot to them. Obviously, these are small businesses that, you know, there's human stories behind all these breweries and closures. So they're difficult. But I think generally what we're seeing is kind of a shift from an industry that had been on a growth trajectory for a long time, kind of coming back to earth a little bit. And the closure rate that we're seeing now is probably more in line with other industries. And that's a sign of a maturing industry that's kind of settling back into a normal pace of openings and closings and kind of that turnover that happens in, you know, a lot of other sectors.
I think to your point, with some of these closures, it really has been kind of an individual, you know, business choice for a variety of reasons that you might make with a restaurant or any other kind of business. What are some of the realities that these breweries have been contending with?
Yeah, I mean, the one that's freshest in my mind right now is right here in Milwaukee. 1840 Brewing had its last service, I believe, at the end of June. And that was a tough one because that's really one of the best breweries in the city. And they were doing beers that were really good and were really singular and, you know, unique and distinctive within the kind of mix of Milwaukee beer as it stands here in 2025. So it was a tough one. And I think it's made worse by everything, you know, the context of it. You know, they had just opened a taproom in West Bend that was delayed for several months with construction and, you know, things that were out of their hands. And then over the winter, the brewery announced that co-founder Stephanie Vetter, who's the wife of head brewer Kyle Vetter, was battling stage 4 cancer. And that was one of the main reasons that Kyle cited in his announcement that they were going to close. That's one example of kind of the combination of a challenging environment, maybe something that didn't quite go right for them in the tap room, and then, you know, personal circumstances. You know, more recently, we just last week, we had Hop and Barrel Brewing in Hudson up near the Twin Cities announce a closing. And they had a, you know, a lot of these breweries have pretty long posts when they announce that they're closing. And I think they kind of, you know, nailed the headwinds for the industry right now. They cited rising costs. This is their quote from them: rising costs, shifting consumer preferences, and growing number of alternative beverages. That's a pretty good shorthand for what I'm hearing from a lot of brewers right now, is that everything's getting more expensive. People are drinking less beer and there's a lot more competition both within beer and from stuff like THC beverages, canned cocktails, you know, the kind of things that are competing for shelf space and competing for consumer attention.
It's been an interesting time in the beverage industry. Of course, you mentioned CBD drinks, a variety of seltzers, alcoholic seltzers that are also in the market now. Has that contributed to some of these decisions where people are maybe trying to figure out how they enter into these different spaces, but, you know, understanding that they are in fact breweries and that do beer?
It's a tough line for them to walk. A lot of the breweries that I follow are getting into that space because they see it as, I guess they see it as a, you know, direct competition. I think there's also just a factor of people are making different choices about how they want to get their buzz, I guess. I mean, I don't usually think of beer as like I'm drinking this to have a buzz, but I do think that there are some people who do. Colorado is one of the earliest states to legalize cannabis. And that's a state with a really robust brewing scene, and they've really leveled off and started to see a downturn. One of their really great breweries called True Brewing just announced last week that they were going to close. So, you know, I haven't really heard a lot of direct references to that here in Wisconsin, but, you know, I think if you watch where brewing companies are putting their energy, some of that is in cannabis and kind of alternative beverages, including NA stuff, which is a different kind of challenge in that it's quite capital intensive to produce NA beer, but it's a growing, but still pretty small, but growing segment that I think some brewers are really looking at for growth opportunity.
Sure. Now, what would you say is the overall impact here in Milwaukee and maybe Wisconsin in general of losing, you know, a number of these craft breweries?
Well, if you'd asked me that about 7 months ago, right around New Year's, there were a lot of these. And that kind of makes sense in terms, if you think like a bank, the ability to catch up on a loan that might be behind is a lot lower in January and February during really slow months for breweries than it is during the high season, which we're in right now. But yeah, they were coming really fast and it was disheartening. What we're seeing now is kind of a second wave of revivals or reopenings. You know, Mobcraft was the first one. Well, not the first one, but it was one of the first last year that closed at the end of November. And there was a story not too long after that in the spring that Mobcraft was going to be coming back with new ownership who has ties to the former branch. One of the new ownership team is a bookkeeper from the previous business. So we've seen Lombardi Brewing Company come into City Lights Brewing in the Menominee Valley. We've seen St. Francis Brewery, which had been dormant for years, reopen this spring under new ownership and are basically operating as a brew pub again. And even further afield, like Bull Falls in Wausau, it's one of the bigger breweries there. They announced they were closing last fall and they are reopening under new ownership and with fresh rebranding and all that stuff. So there's certainly an impact, but I kind of feel like a lot of these places are turning over instead of just closing outright. So there's a few that hasn't been the case with, including Enlightened, which was a tough one to lose. We don't know what's going to happen with 1840 yet, but hopefully that mitigates some of the impact on the communities and, you know, the local economy.
Does that make you hopeful for the future of craft brewery? Do you think, you know, this might be a temporary lull?
I don't know. I mean, I think some of these headwinds that these breweries are talking about are not necessarily just blips, you know. But I mean, I look at where people who know this industry are placing their bets, and there's a lot of openings. I mean, we just had Clockwork Brewing. Their plans became clear for opening a pretty big kind of old school almost brewery in Menominee Falls. They're built on a distribution model that's very similar to Third Space or Lakefront, you know, the kind of the breweries that we know and understand, you know, in terms of distribution and pretty big size. So we've had an own opening in Fond du Lac Beer Company just opened at the end of June. And, you know, that's a community that was the biggest place in Wisconsin that didn't have a brewery of its own. We've got a new brewery called Vault 202 opening in Appleton, smaller breweries kind of in the works in Hartford, Boulder Junction, Beaver Dam, Union Grove. So it's definitely a mixed bag. I mean, there are going to be challenges for all these businesses, but they think there's still a viability, especially in, I think most of these are focusing on kind of, you know, being a community gathering place, you know, space where people can get together and hang out and have a good time and enjoy good drink and good food.
All right. Well, we will see what the future holds. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Glad to be here.
What's made Milwaukee famous has made a fool out of me.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine and the Beer Baron columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up later in the show, we'll remember celebrated poet and performer Andrea Gibson, who passed away this week. But first, we'll meet Wisconsin's poet laureate and learn how she plans to educate Wisconsinites during her tenure. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Brenda Cardenas is Wisconsin's newest poet laureate. She began her three-year term at the start of this year. As the state's ambassador for poetry, the Milwaukee native hopes to inspire creativity through workshops, projects, and meeting with young people. July's issue of Milwaukee Magazine explores how Cardenas works with ekphrastic poetry, a form of poetry that collides with visual art. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by Cardenas to learn more.
Brenda, you're the state's 11th poet laureate. What does it mean to be a poet ambassador for all of Wisconsin?
It's a big role. For me, it means to, in a way, spread the good news of poetry, right? Through workshops, through readings, through talks, to move about the state, both rural and urban, to help people be able to enjoy poetry, access poetry, you know, not think that poetry is something that's only for, you know, academics up in the ivory tower and that it's impossible to understand, which I think sometimes poetry gets a bad rap, right? You know, this poem has to mean X, whereas actually poems can have many different interpretations, and a reader always brings their own experience and their own worldview to anything they read. So it's to help people realize that it doesn't have to be that hard to understand or even to write, and also to bring some joy, because we're living in, I mean, I guess every generation can say this, but we're living in some pretty tough times right now, right? And there's a lot of division. And so I'm hoping that poetry can bring people together and that I can help do that through it.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And for listeners who aren't familiar with your poetry, can you tell me about your work and how you approach your writing?
Well, I write about many, many different things. There's not one theme in my work at all. Some of the themes or ideas that are present in over a number of poems over the years, I write about my culture as a Mexican American woman and my own family history. Sometimes I code switch, go back and forth between Spanish and English in some of my poems. Another kind of concern of mine is the environment, right? So I also write poems that people might call eco poems that are observing something about the natural world that I'm hoping that through the poem others can come to appreciate, because once we appreciate the natural world, then we don't want to destroy it. And sometimes I, rather than thinking ahead of time, I let language lead me. And it's more about creating a word bank, right? And just allowing the language, like a very interesting phrase, phrasing something in a way no one's ever phrased it before, and allowing that line to be what spawns the rest of the poem. So I sometimes don't even know what the poem's going to be about until I finished writing it. And I think that's important because, You know, as poets, our material is language. You know, the visual artist has their paints or their sculpting clay, you know, their materials, right? Their paints, their paintbrush that they're using. We have words, we have language. And I think it's important to remember that language is material and we can play with it and we can move it around and do all kinds of different things with it, which makes writing a lot of fun.
That's so beautiful, the way that you put it that way. So creative. And I also understand that you have an appreciation of art in various forms, but what do you love most about poetry that has kept you connected to it?
Some poems tell stories, some don't. Some just hold a moment. Different poems do different things. But I think what has always captivated me about the form, even before I wrote it, right? Just when I was reading it, is that poets tend to do whatever they're going to do in a much smaller container, right? Than fiction writers or non. And I really appreciate fiction and nonfiction too. Don't get me wrong. I love to read no matter what it is. But I love the way it's condensed. And I also, again, love that poets try to say something. I mean, what we say, the ideas aren't always new. Often they're not new. It's the way that we say it. It's how we frame it. It's the way that we frame it through an image so that you, as the reader, can take that image in your mind and you can see it in your mind's eye and it all unfolds before you. Or the way that we say it through a comparison, a metaphor, say. So we take one thing and we compare it to something else that, you know, you would never think to compare those two things. They seem like they're completely different worlds, but the poet finds what's similar there. Right, and brings them together, and it's a new way of expressing maybe something very old. And so that freshness in the language is another thing that has always drawn me to poetry. Also, you know, I think poetry is music. Poets often pay much attention to the sounds in their poems, the rhythms and the cadences, as well as using alliteration or consonants or assonance, which are just repetitions of different kinds of sounds. And so we're thinking about the internal music of the language. And it's also that imagery, painting with words, right? That's what's always kept me. You know, when I read a poem where the language just blows my mind, I just sit there after I've read it and go, oh, wow, how did that person do that? How fantastic, you know?
Right, that's amazing. And part of being Wisconsin's Poet Laureate is to create a project and work on it throughout your term. Can you tell me about the project you proposed?
Yes, I've always had a love for visual art, and I don't make it myself, but my brother is a visual artist, and many people in my family, they would never have called themselves visual artists because they were laborers to make their living, but they had that ability, they had that talent. So I've always been drawn to art. And so what the project does is it's what I would call an ekphrastic relay. And what ekphrasis is it's just a mode of poetry in which a poet is inspired by a work of visual art, or writing a poem that's in some way in conversation with a work of visual art. It's interpreting that work of visual art, or it's just a jumping off point for the poet to riff off of, right? And that's all that means. So in my project, there's a website that I had a web designer create for me, and it's called WisconsinPoetLaureateProject.com, all smashed together, WisconsinPoetLaureateProject.com. And we divided the state into seven regions. And if a poet wants to participate, they just go in there to the website and you register as a poet within your region. If a visual artist wants to participate, they do the same thing. They go in and they register as a visual artist within their region. And then the site has all kinds of prompts, me talking about ekphrasis, all kinds of materials. So you don't have to know about this mode. You know, it's all right there for you. The first 10 or so poets in each region that sign up, they can put up an ekphrastic poem that is responding to or inspired by any work of art in the world. and they post that, right? Then visual artists who have signed up look at those poems, pick one, and make a piece of visual art that is inspired by that poem. They photograph it, they put it up on the website. Then a new set of poets comes along, more poets sign up, they look at those pieces of visual art, they write a poem that's inspired by one of the pieces of visual art, they put it up. Then more visual artists come along, right? So it's in a way like the old game of telephone or a relay, right? Where what began it and what's going to be at the end of that relay will be very, very different from one another. And it's this back and forth, back and forth. And all of the pieces, both the poems and the photographs of the visual art, will all be archived on this website. So everybody will be able to look at everybody's.
Right. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, would this be exhibited somewhere? But that's amazing that, you know, this will be open for really anyone to check out and register. Well, I also understand that something that you enjoy doing as a poet is collaborating with artists of other media, like you mentioned, like musicians, choreographers, and visual artists. And a project of yours that stood out to me is your poem Para los Tintunderos, which was set to choral music by Daniel Alfonso. So let's listen.
Este para los timbaleros, los bateristas, los tintunderos. Este para los timbaleros, los bateristas, los tintunderos.
Los que tocan con cucharas en sus estufas, cantinizas en sus escritorios, camines y cuchillos.
So this is a poem celebrating drummers, right?
Yes, it is definitely. It's a poem that, you know, when I think of drummers in whatever kind of drum it is, whether it's a drum kit that we see rock and roll bands using, or whether it's congas, right, or bongos, whatever it is, right? I think they keep the rhythm for all of us. Even though the poem doesn't say this, if you think about it, drums in history were used to communicate, both by many indigenous peoples and even by African slaves. Like when they were enslaved in the United States and in Britain and other countries, they would use the drums to signal each other, to communicate something to one another over vast distances. So they're really important. But also, just in observing drummers, for a while when I was younger, I worked with poetry and music ensemble called Sonido Inquieto. And the musicians, when they created music for the poems, the drummer, one thing I noticed about the drummer was that, you know, he was always tapping his foot or always, you know, tapping his knuckles or his fingernails. Like whether he was playing the drums or not, he couldn't stop keeping the rhythm. It was observing him that made me initially write that poem.
That is so cool. Well, before we wrap up, I was wondering if you might have any advice for creatives who want to get started in writing poetry.
Oh, first I'd say read, read, read. Read a lot of poetry and read all different kinds of poetry because then you see what's all possible out there. You know, I mean, there was a time when I never had read another Latino or Latina author who mixed Spanish in with their English. When I grew up, they didn't give us anything like that in school, right, to read. And when I first discovered that, when I read I was like, oh my God, I can do that, right? So I think that gives you ideas and examples. And then the other thing I would say is just write. Don't worry about it at first being a poem. You know, just get down your impressions, your observations. Be observant. A poet needs to be observant of the world around them. Then you can bring it to the page. So just write. And if nothing's coming to me, I'm just going to write whatever garbledygook is in my head. Because if you do that, eventually something will start happening.
I need to take this advice for myself. Thank you so much for speaking with me today and for sharing your impactful poetry with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I really appreciate that you even wanted to talk to me. It means so much.
Brenda Cardenas is Wisconsin's 11th Poet Laureate and was featured in July's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You can hear more and listen to Cárdenas recite one of her poems at WUWM.com. Andrea Gibson was a celebrated poet and spoken word artist. Their work explored everything from gender identity, politics, love, loss, life, and death. They were the Poet Laureate of Colorado, a queer activist, author of 7 books, and the subject of the award-winning documentary Come See Me in the Good Light. Gibson was diagnosed with terminal ovarian cancer 4 years ago and passed away on Monday at the age of 49. Gibson's social media stated, quote, "Whenever I leave this world, whether it's 60 years from now, I wouldn't want anyone to say I lost some battle. I'll be a winner that day." In honor of Gibson, we're revisiting their conversation with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski at Boswell Book Company in 2018.
What is it about writing prose and the poetic form that feeds you as a writer? Had you ever tried doing, say, short stories or essays or anything like that, or was poetry always your clear path?
It was my clear path just because I want something to get done right away. I never had the patience to write anything longer. I've only just recently, I'm working on a memoir right now, and it's sort of my first time diving into anything longer. But with poetry, I just loved how you could write it, and then it, you know, you didn't have to spend a year writing it. Right. Yeah.
In your poem in this book, Lord of the Butterflies, it's titled, "What Do You Think About This Weather?" And there's a line that says, your mother used to knit your mittens too big so that you'd kind of grow into them, and that you felt the same way about writing your poems, like they don't fit yet. But now that this is here and tangible in a published book, do you feel that way still? Or is it something that's always constantly changing?
Yeah, well, I just was having such sweet images about my family. You know, when I grew up in a very working class town in rural Maine, and people didn't have a lot of money. So you made your mittens too big so that you could wear them for many years. But I feel that way about poems mostly because I rarely write where I am. I write where I want to be. So my best self is in my poems because I try to write them down and then try to live in that direction. They're sort of like little molds of you know, where I dream to be, especially with hopeful poems or very positive poems. I might be in the most negative space in the world when I'm writing it, and I want to get to a different space or even a more enlightened space. My poems are wiser than I am by far. I'm a little 3-year-old throwing a tantrum a lot of the times. But yeah, I think that this book has been the first book where it's gotten a little bit braver with saying, you know, there's a poem in the book called No Filter where I'm more direct about sucking sometimes. You know, I have this dream of writing a book called Bad Guy, just all about myself, because there's been a way that when you have a platform like this and you're writing about the things that I'm writing about, I get lots of comments and stuff of, you're so wonderful. And that's, you know, because you don't see me when I'm in a bad mood and I'm a jerk or something like that. So I want to write a jerk book someday and sell out all my negative qualities.
Well, I think everyone's a jerk most
of
the time.
Yeah, we all are. I mean, that's the thing. We all are. But poets get to present themselves as not a jerk if they want to. And so that's not fair.
So when you're in a bad mood and you're trying to write an uplifting poem, how long does it take you to get in that headspace to get to that, you know, poem of enlightenment or wherever your goal of, I'm here right now, but this poem is going to make me better?
It's usually pretty easy to do because the creative process for me almost always just lifts me into a better space. That's when I'm the happiest. It's when I feel most connected. It's when time just passes like that. I can spend 12 hours in a room writing and it will feel like 10 minutes. I can be on a 5-hour plane ride and can't believe that it's passed so quickly if I'm writing. But yeah, pretty quickly.
Do you prefer to handwrite your poems, or does it mix depending on what you have at the moment?
I write out loud mostly, I guess, unless I'm on a plane or something. But I write pacing the room, walking around, yelling things, whispering things. If anybody ever walks in on it, it's very awkward. Also, because a lot of the times I don't have the words yet. I just have the sound. I know how I want the poem to sound, and then the words might come later after I know the sound and emotion of the poem. So not only are people walking in on me talking to myself, but they're walking in on me talking to myself and not words. It's something that you really can't pull off with other people around, unless you're... I actually can write... when I'm walking around the streets of like New York City, nobody cares. There, yeah.
People might be concerned here. If you
yeah, know. Yeah. Milwaukee, they might stop and
ask.
Are
you
me
okay?
About, yeah. But in New York, they don't flinch. Yeah.
Well, that kind of touches upon my next question. So there's a cadence to your performances. But if a reader, say, picks up this book as a novice to poetry and sees the format, there's, you know, your quick definition poems, there's poems that are single space, fill up the whole page, some go from, you know, margin to margin. Are you writing that for your performance cadence, or is it writing it differently for the reader?
I keep getting asked the question about all the forms in the book because they're more creative than any other book that I've done. And that is almost entirely my girlfriend's doing. She's a poet as well. And what we did is we sort of sat down and I would say the poem to her and she would try to capture it. She knows a lot about form. And so she would try to capture how I say the poem to live on the page and the way that she felt like people would read it the way that I say it. I know virtually nothing about form. I hardly paid attention in school. It's not my craft, really. I come to the page sort of accidentally. I didn't ever plan on doing my first book. The publisher contacted me and said, let's make a book. And at that point, I didn't even have poems on my computer. They were just all in my head. And so I had to just start typing them all out and figure out how to put them on a page.
Is that where you were forced to have poetry and spoken word converge? And where do you think they diverge from each other?
Well, I think what's great about recently is that line is really getting blurred. A lot of really successful, talented spoken word artists are now having a lot of success, you know, getting nominated for the National Book Award and stuff. And so people are showing that they can exist in both spaces and exist powerfully and beautifully. So I think that there's not as much separation as there used to be. I think publishers are more inclined to publish spoken word artists. And I think that line is sort of going away. And I also think that traditional page poets are starting to think, oh, maybe I should learn how to read a poem out loud, you know, because I've gone to see some of my favorite page poets read, and it can be boring. And you want to try to figure out how to make your, you know, move your voice in a way so that you're capturing the emotion of your poem, I think.
Do you feel more comfortable on the printed space since you were mostly spoken word, you're memorizing your poems and, you know, having other people's hands in the formatting of your published books, do you feel like you're gaining strength in both areas or learning from each one as you put more printed pieces together?
Yeah, I do think. I think that I'm learning about it. We were talking about it earlier. I love, the one thing I love about the page are line breaks, honestly, because that's something that is, you know, I just love reading in books. And so you can't ever capture it, really, when you're performing a poem out loud. Sometimes I want to stop and tell the audience, did you get that line break there? That was a good line break. But you can't do that.
Do you find that certain subjects lend themselves to either spoken word or poetry more than the other? Are there certain subjects you only want to do without a printed book in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of poems that are political poems, social justice poems that feel like rally cries or protest poems, I often want to just have those memorized, and because it also makes a difference to me to be able to make eye contact with people. That was one of the things that made me fall in love with spoken word from the beginning, is it felt like this conversation, and I don't think the audience ever really knows how much of the poem they're pulling out of a poet, because, you know, you're talking to people, you're seeing their eyes, and you're responding to how other people are responding emotionally, and you know, it helps when you're in spoken word settings where people are giving a lot of vocal feedback. It helps pull along. But if that's not happening, you want to be able to see people. And when I'm looking at the page, it's hard to do. But just the energy of it, I think energy always just lifts if you're seeing people's eyes.
Where do you think the intersection of poetry and social change meet? Do you think it's a poet's job or anyone of influence to be the people to affect change, or are you simply recording your experience and it happens to be activism? What is it for you?
I think it's different for everybody. I think in this political climate, it's a radical thing to tell the truth when so many lies are being told. So just the simple act of telling the truth, I think, is political. I also think that creating art and making, even if you're writing about flowers, to put beauty into this world right now, to me, is political and radical, because it's such a destructive culture that it's just, you know, it's going up and battling the destruction to make something lovely. For me, I don't necessarily like writing political poems at all. If I had my way, I'd only write love poems, which queer love poems are political in a way, or in every way. But I just enjoy writing poems that are hopeful and, not to keep saying the word, but lovely and loving and funny. I enjoy writing that sort of stuff. I don't enjoy writing poems like the one about Orlando. I don't enjoy writing that stuff, but that's where the world is, and that I can't not write it.
We do have a sizable crowd here tonight, and, you know, many people would argue that poetry has its fluxes throughout time. You know, we went from, I'm sure, you know, raise of hands, I'm sure a lot of people read, like, the Iliad, Homer, like, epic poetry in high school, and then maybe forgot about it afterwards. But do you feel like prose and poetry are no longer competing as hard, or do you feel like poetry is having a resurgence now?
Whenever people talk about poetry being dead, or I've heard that people aren't buying as many books. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that's probably true with books of poetry. I feel like poetry is flourishing right now. I think specifically with spoken word and button poetry and how poetry is reaching so many youth and people who don't think that they like poetry coming to poetry readings. When I first started performing, nobody came to poetry readings except poets. And I wanted that to change so much because, you know, people go, we all go to see bands that we love, even if we're not musicians. So I always wondered, why aren't people who aren't writers coming to hear poetry? And so it was my dream, it still is my dream, that all these you know, rock clubs around the world get filled up with poets. And I see that happening. I see all these spoken word artists starting to tour rock clubs and music venues. And I think that they should be in those spaces. And I think it's a testament to just people who don't identify as writers, like, falling in love with poetry. And so I from what I witness, I see it growing. And And more and more young people getting involved. Some of my favorite poets are 20.
Do you think it's both the responsibility of poets and, say, people here in the audience to foster that growth?
I mean, I don't know if you can tell anybody it's a responsibility to love what they love. You know, love what you love. You don't like poetry, like, who cares? But I do think that a lot of people don't know that they love poetry. And so if you love poetry, try to, yeah, let's just say sneak it. Give only poetry as Christmas or holiday, as holiday gifts this year. Yeah.
Well, with poetry, people often come to it the first time as an assignment.
Yeah.
Was that the case for you? I mean, you mentioned you brought in your favorite poet to play for your English teacher, but what are some of your other school experience with either English classes or in being exposed to poetry and deciding like, hey, I think I'll give this a whirl?
I did like it. I remember liking it right away because it was emotional. And I think that I had so many feelings that felt inappropriate. You know how this world makes you feel like feelings are inappropriate when it's basically what makes us. And I remember it being one place where I felt like even if the discussions in the class weren't putting that in the forefront of the conversation, I could feel it. I felt like this is one place where you're given permission or almost expectation to be emotional. And I didn't have that anywhere else in my life. And so I think it was, poetry was the first thing that said, cry and, you know, feel things.
Andrea Gibson was a celebrated poet and spoken word artist. They passed away on Monday after living with terminal cancer. That conversation with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski took place in 2018 at Boswell Book Company. When we come back, Milwaukee historian John Gerda shares what you can find in his book that was decades in the making, John Gerda's Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For fans of Milwaukee history, there is one name that comes to mind as the leading expert on the city, John Gerda. He's written extensively about the city in his columns in the Journal Sentinel, his many books on the city, and even in the documentary series, The Making of Milwaukee. John Gerda's Milwaukee is a guidebook to the city that provides detailed maps of routes through different Milwaukee neighborhoods. Gerda joined me in 2023 to share more about it. How did you develop this guide?
This began as a tour that I was leading for nonprofit groups, especially back in the 1970s, and did that for close to 50 years, and developed a route that I thought really kind of showed off Milwaukee at its most characteristic. And I always had, it wasn't quite a bucket list, but I knew that as I took people around the city, all this knowledge would kind of die with me if I didn't have, you know, some way of getting this into the public domain. So this project was born, and it was essentially a means of downloading things I'd learned into a format that people could take the tour on their own. That's pretty much what it amounts to.
So in some ways, this is a project that started in the 1970s, but these are new maps, and a lot of the sites are relatively new, I would say. One that sticks out in my mind is Versity. That's one that was listed in there. But many of them, the majority of them, are historical sites.
They are, and I think it's important to underline that just as you can't step into the same river twice, you can't tour the same city twice. It's always changing. And what I said, the introduction to this, the guidebook, John Gerda's Milwaukee, was that I hope that someday people would look at this book, you know, dust it off, you know, 50 years from now, and look at it the same way I look at the WPA writer's guides from the 1930s, you know, kind of a take on a vanished city, but one that's pretty fascinating, you know, just kind of to see how much change there's been. And what it underlines is the basic dynamism of the city as an organism, which I think is always fascinating, you know, in Milwaukee and everywhere else.
Now, there are so many neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. It would be impossible to have a guide of this size, of this kind, and get to every neighborhood. How did you decide which neighborhoods to include in the guide?
It was a matter of looking at a blend of manageability and variety and diversity. So certainly you got to start downtown. That's where the heart of Milwaukee is. And you certainly have to do west side, north side, east side, south side. So you kind of begin with those cardinal points and look at what you can do in a half day and say this is kind of the mix of neighborhoods and landmarks that's going to show people, you know, what Milwaukee is, who Milwaukee is.
Well, and is that the goal, that someone's going to take this guide and really spend the day with it and go through all of these neighborhoods?
My intention, my hope is that people, if you're on a bike, probably best spend over a couple days. But you can do this in a half day in a car without a great deal of trouble. Probably don't start at rush hour. Although in Milwaukee, some of the bus tours I lead would be after work. And we leave at 5 and get back at, 7:30 or 8. And Milwaukee is such a manageable city, such a human scale city, that you can do that. You know, in Chicago, it would be completely impossible. So, yes, I think this should be one experience. And people can certainly, this is linear, so you can chop it up into as many segments as you want. You know, spend an hour every Saturday kind of poking around town. So I think people may do it sequentially, or they may do it all in one gulp. But my hope is that they kind of come back with an enlarged sense of what Milwaukee is, and again, who Milwaukee is, and also kind of a sense of the diversity and the vitality. As I said near the end of the tour, there's no section of Milwaukee that this tour touches on that does not have some signs of new life, energy, dynamism again.
This guide is largely specific routes through neighborhoods. There are maps for each neighborhood and instructions, turn left at this street, Right. Pull over here or there. What do you think that kind of specificity gives to a person who's exploring the city?
I think it provides kind of a through line from which they can deviate. So you start with, pretty much, it's a real sloppy figure eight. So it kind of winds around downtown, west, north, and east, and comes across through the Third Ward into Walker's Point, Southside, Bayview. So I think it provides kind of like the armature for a sculpture. It's kind of it's the outline, it's the bones, it's the skeleton of an urban experience. But certainly, if people want to get lost, they should absolutely feel free to do so, and that can often be rewarding. But what this does is, I hope, gives people some confidence that you can get from here to there without getting too mixed up, too lost.
Fairly manageable in a city like Milwaukee.
Right, exactly.
Now, of course, this is a guide that is specific, does have maps, does include specific sites, but it also includes just information about the neighborhoods themselves. How much would you say this balances what is visible and what is, invisible in the neighborhood, kind of the history, the things that were there?
Good question. I think the emphasis here is very pronouncedly kind of on the human side of the city. So it's about the people who lived and live. And I both lived and live, in all these neighborhoods. So I've always said the past, history is why things are the way they are. The past and present are always kind of commingled. So I think when people see, they go down to Pigsville and they say, here we are on the Menominee Rivers right here, and we get some sort of working class housing. But it kind of takes you back to kind of what the origin story is, why that neighborhood is named the way it is, why people settled there in the first place. And as well, I think people could read this this could be armchair touring as well. So there are kind of capsule histories of Milwaukee's Black community, Milwaukee's Latino community, the Polish South Side, or the German North Side. So there are, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a distillation of things I've learned over the last 50 years.
There are a lot of neighborhoods that people are going to be familiar with. There's going to be, downtown. Most people have been downtown, Bayview, Walker's Point. What are some of the neighborhoods that you're really excited for people to explore where they haven't maybe been before?
Depends on where you live. So Southsiders sure. should know the North Side, and North Siders should know the South Side. We should have that kind of reciprocity going on. But when I would do the bus tours or other vehicles from trolleys to limousines, Pigsville was always a hit because you can't get there unless you're going there on purpose or you're lost, down there in the Menominee Valley. That was always a treat. And there are, 11 streets there, 7 end and dead ends. So you can see the whole thing. You can do a comprehensive overview of Pigsville. But some of the ones that I think are fascinating, you get around Lindsay Heights on the north side, you know, kind of see the German origins and then becoming an African-American community over the years. And some of the developments on the north side, Halyard Park, Bronzeville, Brewers Hill, Harambe, there's a lot going on there. And I think people who have not been there for a while will kind of say, oh, there's something interesting going on. And conversely, on the south side, one story that always, you know, got people sort of say, what? Was my grandmother was raised on 14th Street, a Polish immigrant family. And on her lot, there were 5 houses and 27 kids, you know, so 3 baseball teams. And that never fails to get at what? So that is very apparent in the landscape. You know, you see all these Polish flats on the south side, and you say, my, that was an extraordinarily dense neighborhood that had an extremely strong sense of place.
For sure. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and the author of many books on the topic, including John Gerda's Milwaukee. We spoke in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The monarch butterfly population has been on a steep decline, but this year, the population has nearly doubled. We'll learn more about that tomorrow on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.